from down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapults to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
A spokesman for the Pew Research Center recently said if America has a national religion, it is technology. It is science. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. And because of that, we talk a lot on this program about the transhumanist movement. And it would only seem logical that a national religion, which transhumanism is attempting to become through the promise of immortality by science, by technology, through merger of biology with technology, that it would hold a gathering in virtual space rather than in what they would refer to as meat space. Our guest was an attendee, and we're thankful that he was there so he can give us some context and a better understanding of what this is all about. He's the founder and chief editor of the excellent online journal Forcing Change. It's our honor to welcome our friend Carl Tykrib back to the bunker. Carl, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, thank you, Derek. And I'm glad we're tackling this topic. It's important, very important, because we're seeing such an interesting development take place in the world of technology and religion.
Yeah, it's counterintuitive, I think, for most listeners of our audience, I would suspect, who, for most Christians, let me be more general, to assume or to understand that there is a religion developing from a belief in technology rather than a belief in a transcendent other, you know, an external non-corporeal entity. I mean, as Christians, we sort of assume that you have to believe in God to be a Christian, or to, you know, believe in a God or multiple gods if you were, you know, pagan. But here in the transhumanist movement, you know, setting aside those that are religious transhumanists, like the Mormon Transhumanist Association, the Christian Transhumanist Association, you've got a group that really is upfront about its faith in technology as a means to an end. And that end, of course, is transcending the limits of biology to become immortal and possibly omnipotent. Specifically, you attended a gathering of a group called the TerraSim. The TerraSim movement?
That's right. TerraSim as an organization has been around for a while. I believe it goes back to about 2004. TerraSim, it considers itself a trans-religion. And Derek, where I first ran into the TerraSim movement was at the 2013 Mormon Transhumanist Movement Association, their annual conference, where we had a speaker from TerraSim. And I spent some time talking with him, a very nice individual, very approachable, and he gave us a rundown of what TerraSim was all about and how it fit hand in glove as a secular faith that seeks transcendence, that seeks immortality, that is a type of faith that moves between both the secularist side and the religious component, incorporating ritual, incorporating prayer, meditation, yoga, and all of this fitting hand in glove with technology, with the idea of mind uploading, building a profile online, a profile where you will journal everything, where you will journal your thoughts, your feelings, you upload pictures of yourself, upload videos, with the idea that down the road, the technology will become so advanced that when you pass away with this massive database of personal information, they will be able to upload what would be essentially your personal identity, your consciousness, not necessarily your consciousness per se, but the thoughts and feelings and emotions of who you were, and upload all that into an avatar in a virtual space or some other type of non-physical location, some other type of virtual entity, and you will reemerge, you will resurrect, you come alive again with all this data now forming the platform that makes you who you are. So people can interact with you and see you and talk to you, and you can continue to live with the emotions and experiences and all that that made you who you were as you digitized your personality and put it up into the cloud. Strange, sure. At the same time, serious, because this demonstrates simply that the idea of technology, that technology itself becomes our method of saving ourselves.
Mm.
That's what's really key. It's not so much will they succeed. That, to me, that's not even the issue, Derek. The real issue is this represents the idea that man's hands, man's technology becomes our method of salvation.
Is what theologians would call anthropocentric soteriology.
Right.
Yeah, it is just another way then for humanity to try to realize the old lie, ye shall be as gods.
Exactly. There's really nothing new under the sun at all. It just comes around with more technical trappings or maybe a slightly different sales pitch. But the essence remains what it is. And yes, it sounds far out. But the idea that man can become a god, period, is far out. And yet that's the lie we've been living in and expressing, even at the individual level, since Genesis chapter 3.
Hmm. Well, the Terrasim movement is the creation of Martine and Bina Rothblatt. Martine is the former Martin Rothblatt. He is transitioned from, or he's living as a woman, let's put it that way, transgendered. But he is not a crackpot by any stretch of the imagination. He's an attorney. He's an author. He's an entrepreneur. He's the creator of Sirius Satellite Radio.
Right.
Currently chairman and CEO of United Therapeutics. So this is a very intelligent, very successful person.
Yes, and if you're using SiriusXM Radio, you're using his product.
Exactly. So he and his wife, Bina, have created this religion as a means of achieving this goal. What are some of the tenets of the Terrasim movement, and what were they doing in the virtual world Second Life this week that you attended?
Well, first of all, I'll give you the core beliefs, and I only have four core beliefs, and then I'll jump into why Second Life, why virtual reality. The first is as a core belief, and they have this put down on their website, and there's a number of different websites from Terrasim, but the TerrasimFaith.net website puts it this way. Life is purposeful. That's their first belief. Death is optional. God is technological. And love is essential. And so those are the four tenets of the Terrasim system. And so life as purposeful, it's about diversity, it's about immortality, it's about of becoming purposeful in our design for living, and not just living in the here and in the now, but potentially living beyond the constraints of your own immortal body, which fits hand in glove with the second one, which is death is optional. If there's enough information, and this is how they couch it, if there's enough information that can be preserved from that individual, which is this idea of mind uploading or uploading your journaling, your pictures, your videos, your personality, eventually down the road there will be an ability to resurrect yourself. And then God is technological. The concept here is that we are creating God. We are making God. God is becoming alive through our thoughts and our actions, which fits with how kind of Teilhard de Chardin, the Catholic Jesuit mystic, who was one of the forefathers of the whole transhumanist movement, he envisioned God as being actualized through the expansion of our thought and our deeds and our actions as humanity. We end up with a type of a Christo evolution. And this came through even at the event I was in Second Life. We're looking at a Christo evolution where God is realized, Christ is realized, the Christ consciousness is realized through our actions. And then finally, love. Love. Everything needs to have this underlying theme of love. We need love because this puts us in contact with others in relationship. There is happiness. There is a sense of fulfillment. There is an emotional and an intellectual connection than we have with each other. It's not just simply utilitarian.
Hmm.
So those are the four structures of Terrasim. And it's not a religion that has churches planted all over the place. It really is an online, and specifically, you'll find quite a bit of their work within the virtual world. It's really an online type of platform for introducing a trans religion, a religion that crosses the boundaries, and that's how they describe themselves.
Well, that seems appropriate. What was the purpose of the gathering that the Terrasim movement held this week?
Well, every year, and for the last 10 years, and this is the 10th one this year, it was their annual workshop on geoethical nanotechnology. And the theme for this year's event was to take a look at how Jesuits and scientists, Teilhard de Chardin, would feel about nanotechnology and how the beliefs and the philosophies of Chardin work hand-in-hand to some extent with the Terrasim movement and with transhumanism in general. Now, Terrasim has been in Second Life for a long time. They have a fairly large island, a solarium city. I've attended different conferences since, I'm guessing, 2010 or so at Solarium, at the Terrasim site in Second Life. And some events are fairly large. Last year there was one that was large enough it crashed the whole system, and which was kind of disappointing because it disrupted the entire conference. Approximately 100 or so avatars jumped into the island, and it just overloaded the system and crashed. You know, technology. This year, for this particular workshop, is very small. There was only 10 of us that I counted at the height of it, and so it wasn't a huge event. What it was meant to do, more than anything else, is to allow scholars to interact with each other and present different ideas and different papers regarding Teilhard de Chardin and transhumanism in general. So we had people. We did have some interesting folks that were there. Probably the one that is most noted for people is Michael Shermer, who is the founder and the editor of Skepticism magazine.
Right.
Yeah. So he was one of the presenters. Which was pretty amazing, because here we have an individual who would not claim religion. In fact, he was very clear that what we are looking at developing is a type of morality or an ethics built around a secularist idea. And so to have him there was very interesting. And he had a spot towards the end of the conference. And the conference took place, by the way, on Monday.
Okay. That would seem to present some real difficulties, coming up with an ethical system based on humanist foundation, because ultimately that's what this is. It's humanism enhanced through technology.
Right,
because
right.
You know, absent an external source of authority, God, who tells us what is sinful and what is moral, what is right, what is wrong, it all comes down to how things make us feel, basically, doesn't it? Or how do they justify? How do they reach a common ground on what is ethical?
Well, the thing is, we have to keep in mind too, is transhumanism is a humanist religion. It's not a religion that has a revelation from outside of itself. It's a revelation from the internal structure of man and our technology and our development. And so, it came through where one person said, "We are not in evolution; we are evolution."
Self-directed evolution.
Correct.
Which was
and
the
so our morality then evolves with that.
Yeah, and self-directed evolution, of course, was the motto of the 20th century eugenics movement.
Right, right. And this is interesting you bring that up, Derek, because I've had conversations with transhumanists who say, no, this is not about eugenics, realizing that, of course, there is this historical taboo when it comes to the issue of eugenics.
People sure,
shy away
right.
Because of what happened under Nazi Germany. And yet, at the same time, I've had conversations with other leading transhumanists who say, "Of course, this is eugenics. This is just liberal eugenics. This is a liberalizing eugenics." And so, it's like, yeah, you know something. You're right. It is eugenics.
Yeah, I don't see how they can. Well, there's no way to escape it. I mean, ultimately, that's what it is. Because unless you exercise some judgment over who gets to upgrade. then right. then you're basically saying that the next Adolf Hitler or Pol Pot or Joseph Stalin or you know whoever will then be given superpowers as you know the rest of us upgrade. So
well, and there's people see that there's a distinction between eugenics and what would be considered, I guess, the non-eugenic or the liberal eugenic side of it, and that is that eugenics is viewed as being a top-down approach. It's being enforced upon you, where and that's I think some of the problem that even the transhumanist community, Derek, and you know this just as well as I do, they themselves are wrestling with: are we a religion? Are we not a religion? Mm-hmm. Are we eugenics? Are we not eugenics? The idea of eugenics coming down as a top-down approach is troubling to the transhumanist community. But at the same time, I don't think that it could come about almost any other way.
No.
It's something imposed from above.
Yeah, because...
Whereas other transhumanists have spoken with and said, no, we're all about having individual choice. This is about individual direction. So therefore, it's a more of a liberal, liberating idea of eugenics. This is why in 2013 at the Global Future 2045 International Congress, there was a letter to the United Nations asking them to step up to the plate and become the new guiding director for an international transhumanist movement, because we need some type of top-down approach. Otherwise, it's just going to flounder around until we find somebody who can capture it and direct it in a specific course or down a specific road.
Yeah, and there have already been calls from those in the movement to consider restrictions on human breeding, because as much as they want this to be about individual choice, individual purpose, when you really poke at the clump of beliefs there that they can kind of agree on, you also get to this understanding that not everybody should be allowed to reproduce.
Right.
Okay. I mean, right. Are you really saying that you've got, there's really kind of an ugly core here that they don't want to admit, and I don't know if it's willing ignorance or just a naivete about the goodness of government or the goodness of people in general. But when you get right down to it, well, for example, there's some statistics that have come out in the wake of the revelations about Planned Parenthood openly soliciting buyers for the fetal body parts that they collect in the course of their abortion practices over the course of a year, that more African-American babies are aborted in New York City every year than are born.
Wow.
Okay. Black Lives Matter, except if you're in New York City, apparently. And it's a substantial difference, too. A higher percentage of unborn black children will be aborted in New York City than actually brought to term and allowed to grow. And now, in the transhumanist movement, if we are all granted the possibility of immortal life, I'm still trying to formulate the words to bring these ideas out and kind of crystallize them in a concise way. But where do children fit into this? I mean, they talk about love, but where do children fit into this? How do we, get away from this culture of death where children are sort of a optional,
right,
and really more of a burden than anything else? I mean, if we're living in a culture in which nobody ever dies, I've been reading a science fiction novel by an author, John C. Wright, who is a believer. He's Roman Catholic, and that kind of informs some of the theology in his writing. But he's a science fiction writer, and he, in one of his recent novels called Somewhither, creates a number of alternate timeline Earths. And in one of these Earths, where Adam and Eve got their hands on the tree of life so that humans never die, on that particular world, children are just abandoned at birth. Because, you know, why should we bother? They're not going to die. So why should we bother, you know, doing anything to them? I mean, we just, okay, they never die. Well, how do you deal with the problem of overpopulation? Well, constant war.
Right.
Okay,
well, it's interesting
but
to bring that up.
And
that's because the reason I'm saying it's interesting, because this is stuff that the transhumanist community themselves, these are issues that they themselves are wrestling with. What happens if we do have a world of immortality? what happens now with overpopulation? How do we deal with overpopulation?
Right, right. And in this fictional world, that well, the answer to that was you bury your opponents so deeply that they can't ever get out. So they spent – essentially, you're condemning them to eternal torment.
Wow.
And plus, when you're dealing with a world in which people can never die, then you're giving vent to cruelties beyond anything that we can imagine. Because when you've got somebody who you need to extract information from, you can't threaten them with death. So the only thing you can threaten them with is unending and unbearable pain. And, of course, we know that there are some people in this world who are capable of inflicting that kind of torture on other people. So, you know, again, how do we and how does this Terrasem religion, how does the transhumanist religion account for that? I mean, the Christian worldview accounts for that there is an ultimate judge outside of humanity who is above humanity.
Right.
We will never become God or be equal with God. We are not his co-creators. We will be subject to his judgment someday.
And what you're seeing, when you've been talking, the thing that strikes me, Derek, is that the heart of this problem is the issue of sin.
Yes.
And sin, if you boil it down to what it really means, is our rebellion against God's order.
Yes.
Our rebellion against what God himself dictates. And the heartbeat of that is when we claim that we are who he is. And as soon as we put ourselves on that pedestal, then we've literally unleashed Pandora's box, and we are not subjecting ourselves to God, to a higher standard. We become that higher standard. And so literally anything and everything can happen and does happen. Historically, it does. And there is no other recourse than in a non-God humanistic world, or pardon me, a non-transcendent outside of creation humanistic world. There is nothing that constrains or motivates us to do what we would consider the ethical things, except our own intellect, our own desires, mm-hmm. our own emotions.
Right, right.
Things continually evolve. Here's an example. I was at the Canadian Museum of Human Rights a couple of weeks ago, and it's a tremendously magnificent building. It's basically the Tower of Babel wrapped around in clouds of steel and glass, a massive, massive structure. And you walk through this ziggurat-like internal structure and going up to the top of what's called the Tower of Hope. And at the very bottom, in the first gallery, what struck me was it was explained in one of the sections of that gallery, the boast was made that human rights is constantly evolving. It's constantly changing and revolving it for the next generation. And I was like, when I was hearing that, I was going, hold on. If that's the case, then human rights itself is illusionary, because what is the right for today does not necessarily mean what is right for tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Things all change. And why are we saying that this is a human rights abuse, and the other thing is not a human rights abuse? If it's in flux, then we have no standard upon which to say this is wrong, this is right, because it all changes.
Feet firmly planted in midair. I'm looking at a photo of the Canadian Museum for Human Rights, and your description is very apt. It is a ziggurat-like building wrapped in steel and glass, a very appropriate modern representation or image, or symbol, rather, for...
Right. That's interesting. I'm glad you took a look at that, because Architect Magazine back in 2011 recognized that when this museum was in its initial construction stages, that the archetype of this building was a Tower of Babel.
Yeah.
And the architect himself, Predock, wrote that this was a symbol that unified humanity. This is a symbol that was common to mankind and that unified humanity. You know, this is, again, what transhumanism is all about. This is about unifying humanity around what we build. It's around what we construct as a symbol of what is already taking place in the inward man, which is our pride and our hubris to say, I will rise. I will be like the Most High. I will be as God.
Mm-hmm.
And we see this in Genesis 3, and if I'm honest with myself, Derek, it plays out in my own life too, because I look at what I want to accomplish and what I want to do, and it's about what I want to do. Mm-hmm. Not always about what God wants to do.
Yeah. No, absolutely correct. The five I wills, Isaiah 14, representing Lucifer, Satan, Hillel ben Shakar, whatever name you want to give him, his desire to supplant God in the supreme position in the pantheon. And yeah, I'm going to post a picture of this Canadian Museum for Human Rights in the show notes, because it is, as I said, it is clearly a symbol for our modern religion, which is humanity turned up to 11, humanism turned up to 11.
Right.
And very appropriate, too.
I'm working on a book project right now, and I've got a chapter in my book that deals with Cosmopolis, the idea of these symbols in architecture that proclaim man's divinity, that proclaims man constructing his own order, his own way. And I know sometimes people roll their eyes when you talk of transhumanism and the idea of a technical singularity and a technical deity. This is what we talked about in the Second Life conference with Terrasim, and that is creating a deity or recognizing deity through our technology.
Mm.
And I know, like I said, people sometimes roll their eyes and goes, this is way out. The bottom line is, and this is why it's so serious, is that this is simply another reflection, another example of that Genesis 3 narrative of us going against God and saying we're going to do it our way. And the motive in a non-Christian world to do that seems right to them. It absolutely does seem right to them. Which is bringing up the motive of even why terrorism, why transhumanism, why this movement? Well, it's the logical consequence of believing that this is the right course without acknowledging and bending our knee to the God who created us.
Mm.
It just makes sense to them.
Yeah.
And so we also have to take that seriously, because that is what the world is accepting. And so when we enter our conversations with our friends, our families, when we see this movement and the ideology of it embedded in movies, even in songs and other areas of pop culture, we have to be able to have our eyes open to that, so that when the questions come up with young people, with people we may know, with our own family and our own friends, we'll be able to say, hey, you know, this is the direction. Let's take a look at where this begins. Let's open up that conversation now with them to be able to proclaim to them the true God,
mm-hmm.
not the God of man.
This conversation is helping me appreciate this novel that I referred to earlier, which is called Somewhither by John C. Wright. In the fictional world that Wright creates, our Earth is referred to by the denizens of these alternate Earths, which are ruled, by the way, by something called the Dark Tower, which, spoiler alert, as you read that novel, you discover that the Dark Tower is the Tower of Nimrod, which he was, able to complete in this alternate timeline. They refer to the inhabitants of our world as technomancers, because instead of using astrology and the stars to guide everything as they do in the Dark Tower, we have replaced that in our timeline, our world, with technology. We turn to technology as our God, which again gets back to the, and I should have the gentleman's name in front of me, and I don't. Again, a spokesman for the Pew Research Center recently said that America's national religion, if we have one, and I'm paraphrasing, is science. We are technomancers using science in lieu of magic, or to create the illusion of magic, however you want to look at it,
right.
And doing so to create that new religion. And that is essentially, when you boil it down to its essence, that's the transhumanist movement. That is Terrasim and this trans religion that they're they've created.
We're reaching a stage now where we're seeing multiple versions of spirituality and religion, new forms of religion, operate around the core, the sun of technology, and it circles around just like planets in an orbit. Last year, a book was released, I believe it was by Oxford, called Virtually Sacred. Then I read it, and I've reread sections of it. And Virtually Sacred is a book, it's a secular book, that examines from a sociological perspective the rise of new religious feelings and new religious expressions in the world of Second Life and in the world of Warcraft, which, of course, is one of the largest online gaming platforms on the planet. But for myself, I've been a Second Life user since 2009, and so I found that particularly interesting because I myself have seen where new sacred spaces have formed within that virtual environment. And for people, maybe I need to back up here, for people who don't know what Second Life is, mm-hmm. or what a virtual world is, in terms of especially Second Life, it's a virtual three-dimensional online platform. It's an environment. It's a landscape. It's not a game with an end goal or looking to achieve a certain result. It's a place where you go and model and experiment with a virtual life. And so you have real conversations with real people all hiding behind a virtual representation of themselves called an avatar, which has a Hindu meaning to it as well. There's a lot of symbolism and a lot of parallels here with religion. And it's a place where you can build cities. There are churches. There are I go on occasion to the University of Delaware when they produce some of their similar lecture series and stream it live into their Second Life campus, and then I can participate as somebody in the audience in the Q&A period and ask questions of people like Joe Biden. A couple of years ago, one of his lectures was being live streamed from the University of Delaware into their Second Life campus, and so those of us who were there as avatars, we were being asked by the moderator in real life in Delaware, the actual physical Delaware, the university, what our questions were for Joe Biden. And so here we are sitting in this non-existent reality, and it is a reality. It's a digital reality that's constantly changing, able to throw questions to Mr. Biden.
And as things like the Oculus Rift device, which is being marketed by Facebook and other devices like it. I know Sony's working on one. Microsoft has got one that has put out their 3D immersive goggles or helmets that allow you to see in your full field of vision in this 3D alternate world. These sorts of Second Life is sort of pioneering the virtual reality, meeting space. There are companies out there that market Second Life as a way to reduce your company's carbon footprint by having virtual meetings where people all over the globe can gather, select an avatar and participate in a meeting face to face, similar to the one that you described. But I think that is going to become more and more popular as the interface becomes more and more realistic, more and more lifelike. And
what has to be taken in note is that Second Life is a very old technology.
Yeah.
It's been around for a long time, and it is, as I'm speaking, it is in the process of changing. There is a renaissance, so to speak, in virtual worlds. And at one time, there was maybe only a handful. Second Life was well noted. For kids, there was Club Penguin. That itself was a virtual world. It was just a fun place for kids to hang out and be somebody else through their penguin avatar. But the entire spectrum of virtual worlds has increased dramatically to now there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of virtual platforms out there to work with. I'm on three. I'm on OS Grid and InWorlds besides Second Life. And it's increased tremendously, but what is fascinating with it, it's increasing with also the forward-looking notion that eventually it will become more seamless, it will become more integrated, it will eventually blur the real world, the first world, and the second world in much more substantial ways, which is why I believe it was last year when Facebook bought Oculus Rift for what was it, a billion or 2 billion?
I think it was about a billion or 1.5, but yeah, it was
I mean, because why would Facebook be interested in that? The Oculus Rift is all about virtual, having an enhanced virtual experience. Why would they be interested in a headset like that? Well, because Facebook also knows that's where the trending is going. That's where the line is taking them. And eventually that there will be a much more immersive experience that will take place online using virtual software.
Mm-hmm. And as it becomes more lifelike and more realistic, we can expect that the appeal of these virtual religions or trans religions to grow. Again, as we've said on this program, and I know, Carl, you're very much aware, the church as a whole, very intelligent people are more or less unaware that this is even a thing.
Right, right. And yet, the meeting I was at, though it was small, at Terrasome Island on Monday, July 20th, we had, I'll just tell you who was there in terms of the speakers, Reverend Charles B. Henderson, who is a Presbyterian minister. He spoke on Teilhard and technology and the emergent God that we are moving into, an emergent deity. Hmm. Michael Denon, professor of physics from UC Irvine, was there. Here we have a PhD, a doctor in physics, talking about the idea of a broader reality, that there's an emergence taking place with consciousness in through technology, through virtual spaces, and in other areas, and that free will have to enter this question of evolution, how we now decide our own evolutionary paradigm.
Hmm.
And he's the author of Divine Science, Finding Reason at the Heart of Faith. And so he was speaking about this secularism versus faith and integrating the two together through Chardin's, the lens of the worldview that Chardin looked through. The keynote speaker was Sister Ilia Delio, and she is a nun, or not a nun, I guess not the right word, but she is of the Franciscan order. And she spoke specifically on Teilhard de Chardin, and the idea of love as energy, love is at the heart of evolution. What we're talking about here is becoming, in their words, an emergent human, where we are more being, more conscience. And she raised up an interesting question. We need a new techno-ethics, which came back to what we were talking about earlier, Derek.
Right.
She also talked about the rise of the cosmic person. I'm just looking through some of my notes. And that what we need is now a new type of cosmic hope or a new planetary hope. And that's what a cosmic person would emulate. And that all this is going to come about through the acceptance of the Christ consciousness. And Christ himself is part of our evolving universe. So she described it as a type of Christogenesis. This is what it is. This is the belief structure of where you blend religion and science together, and you form a new type of mystical union between the two.
Yeah.
And of course, Michael Shermer was one of our speakers. Kevin O'Neill, I don't know who he is, but he had a very in-depth presentation on how there are two basic lines of thought in the Catholic Church regarding man's relationship to God. And the first one is the traditional Orthodox belief that God is the source of all and is transcendent outside of our realm, that there is a disconnection because of sin, and that there is a second line of thinking within Catholicism, and of course he was bringing us back to Chardin,
yeah.
And that is the idea that we are created in God's image and that there's a secret connection. We've always been part of God. We've always been divine. Now we need some type of mystical ecstasy to cross the gap between us and God and bridge that separation. So he talked a lot about the new sphere and Omega Point and this type of thing.
Huh.
And then the thing he brought up that was interesting is that Terrasome and Teilhard de Chardin's philosophy, the bottom line is all is one. Maybe with the root of it. And he even talked a little bit about Pope Francis and his the idea that the latest encyclical brings out this idea of all is one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I believe he referenced section 83 or 85. I'd have to look back and see some of my other notes of the new encyclical, where Pope Francis is mirroring some of Chardin's ideas. And then at the very end, we had Martine Rothblatt, who didn't make it in time, I guess, even in Second Life, and the sometimes that rift between Second Life and real life, you can mess up time zones, or you can mess up whatever the situation was, and she just wasn't able to make it, but her slides were all given to us so we could learn about the idea of uniting the cosmos and that God is evolution. All of this is the concept of TerraSim. And TerraSim, one of the slides that was shared from Rothblatt was made a very interesting statement. We are God in the making.
Everything old is new again. Ye shall be as gods.
Right.
And frankly, when I start thinking about the implications thereof, about granting fallen, sinful humans eternal life without being regenerated, I think opening Pandora's box is a good analogy. I think putting it in the words of Tom Horn in the forthcoming documentary Inhuman, science may be opening the gates of hell.
You know, anytime we try to play God, and we've done this in the past, anytime we try to play God, the only thing that we can do is play God against each other, because we can't create worlds out of nothing. Even the virtual worlds are not worlds out of nothing.
That's right.
You know, so all we can do is play God against each other. All we can do is grant life to those who are alive and take life from those also who are alive.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had our fill of people who have done that. We can't seem to get beyond that. And, of course, that's one of the big ethical problems in the transhumanist world, that is, even they themselves, some of them, not all, some of them recognize that there are directions here that could become truly terrifying if it could go to its ultimate end. How far will things go, Derek? I don't know. Yet at the same time, like as I said earlier, what I'm more concerned about is not so much the gadgetry; it is more about what is being said at the heart level regarding who man is in compared to the credit outside of our time and outside of our universe.
Amen. Carl, how do people subscribe to Forcing Change so they can get your monthly updates?
Go to forcingchange.org and you can sign up there. It's a monthly fee. That gives you access to every journal as it comes out and then every back issue going back now almost 10 years. About 1,800 to 2,000 pages of essays, reports, and articles on everything from global governance to transhumanism to environmentalism, deep green, the ecology movement. The list is long as we take a look at how these forces, historical forces of change, are impacting the Christian community.
Mm. Carl Treikrub is the chief editor of Forcing Change, online at forcingchange.org. Carl was at the TerraSim Movement's online seminar earlier this week. And, Carl, we appreciate the information and look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks, Derek. We will talk down the road.
Again, forcingchange.org is Carl's website for Forcing Change, which is an excellent online journal. And the monthly fee, very affordable, gets you access to 10 years' worth of archives at forcingchange.org. And things that he was writing about 10 years ago, even further back than that, that have been incorporated into the journal, are becoming ever more relevant as news comes out and the scientific developments that are facilitating the creation of these scientific religions, the transhumanist religion, are mind-boggling. New story out just today as I record this on Wednesday, the 22nd of July, 2005, that scientists at Harvard believe they figured out a way to make the CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing technique safer. And by safer, they mean introduce fewer mutations into the genes that are being edited. The technique is powerful, CRISPR-Cas9, but it does tend to introduce a lot of unintended mutations, some of which are fatal to the developing embryo. That was something that the Chinese researchers who announced earlier this year that they were able to successfully edit the human genome and the human germline, meaning that they made changes in the embryo that could be passed down to future generations. But they had to go through something like 80 embryos before they got one that survived, that was viable, because of the unintended mutations. Well, Harvard believes, or researchers at Harvard believe that they've overcome some of that, or at least partially, where they reduced the incidence of unintended mutations by about 40%. So this is changing on an almost weekly basis. And yet, as we do this, we're in a world where, as I mentioned during the interview with Carl, where more black babies are born or are aborted than born in New York City. And to be crass, I suppose one could say black lives don't matter if you live in New York City or if you belong to Planned Parenthood. But that is taking those statistics and focusing on just one small aspect of it. I mean, the broader problem, of course, is that we live in a culture now where it's okay to abort. And while, according to the statistics released by New York City, the proportion of aborted babies to live births is greater among black women in New York City, there's still a very high percentage of Asian, non-Hispanic, white, and Hispanic unborn children that are aborted, or in the euphemism employed on the statistics released by the city of New York for the year 2013, induced terminations, which is their nice way of saying abortions. It is tragic. In New York City alone in 2013, almost 70,000 children aborted, 120,000 live births. So, you know, if you're an unborn child in New York City, there's a 40% chance, about a 35% chance, that you're going to be terminated before birth. We have turned the worship of Molech into an assembly line. And there is a new video released by the Center for Medical Progress. Another official from Planned Parenthood arguing, caught on hidden video camera, haggling over the prices that Planned Parenthood would charge for the body parts of aborted fetuses, and how they would modify the procedure used to induce a termination in order to preserve as much of the fetal tissue and organs as possible. It's horrific. It is horrific. And it is a shame on our society that it's taken the shock of these videos being made public to prompt members of Congress, for political gain, no doubt, to say, we need to investigate this. Well, yeah. I mean, Planned Parenthood gets more than $500 million in taxpayer money every year. Why are they being funded in the first place? I mean, and that's beyond it. The obvious question is why is what they do illegal? But it's because Christianity, preaching the gospel, teaching that human life is sacred and that God's design for the family, a man and a woman training up their children in the way they should go, has been rejected by our society. Pointed this out in a recent update on Skywatch TV, that following the introduction of no-fault divorce in the United States back in the late 60s and early 70s, prior to that, something like only 5% of children in America were born to single-parent households, and now it's like 41%. And that there are very strong correlations between growing up in a fatherless home, which most single-parent families are, it's the mother with the children, strong correlations between growing up in a fatherless home and drug and alcohol abuse, dropping out of school, violent crime, things like that. So the sins of the parents being visited upon future generations. And Planned Parenthood profiting from the redefinition of unborn life as a gift from God, a blessing, a child created in the image of God, as God's imager, to just a bit of tissue. And not only that, raw material for the biomedical research industry. I don't think it's a coincidence that one of the reasons Planned Parenthood, in materials that it hands out to school-aged children, encourages school-aged children to explore their sexuality. It's marketing. They need to create product that they can sell, take to market. It's horrible, but that's the direction our culture goes. And this is the culture. These are the mindset. I mean, because, you know, America, frankly, is where is the center of this new transhumanist religion. And this is the culture. This is the morality that the transhumanist religion seeks to turn into gods. This would not be heaven on earth. This would be opening the gates of hell. We've got other queries out for future guests. One, I think, will take place sooner rather than later, but just need to confirm a date and time. And until I do that, I won't name names, but it deals with the trafficking of children for the sex trade. And again, that's, you think about that aspect of where humanity goes if we become immortal and omnipotent, the brutality, the cruelty with which children are treated. If we do turn into a race of people in which all are immortal, and that there's no downside to abandoning children, how does our treatment of children then develop in this new transhumanist religion? Anyway, that is a program that'll be coming up soon. A referral and recommendation from Bruce Collins, and that is much appreciated. Our Bible study continuing Sunday morning, and not coincidentally, I think we're going through some of the chapters of the Old Testament now in Leviticus and Numbers. Just finished with Leviticus, dealing with sanctification and righteousness as God prepares to bring the Hebrews into the Holy Land. We post that Bible study about an hour long each Sunday morning by about mid-morning, and that will be posted, and the archives are there, going all the way back to Genesis chapter 1 at gilberthouse.org. Some really interesting stuff on Skywatch TV the last couple of weeks. Gary Stearman taking the guest's chair for the last 2 weeks, discussing his book Time Travelers of the Bible, How the Ancient Prophets Shattered the Time Barrier. Fascinating stuff when you think about it. Gary made a really interesting statement on the program that just aired this week, that time is God's operating system upon which he wrote his plan for salvation. You can catch that on YouTube, or if you've got Roku. Skywatch TV has its own Roku channel now, and you can look at those last couple of weeks, the interviews with Gary Stearman. Again, fascinating stuff when you consider time as just another aspect of reality, and looking at it in that regard as the operating system on which the plan of salvation was written. Fascinating discussion. View from the Bunker, a production of Gilbert House and released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.